We're talking about ATV safety and trail conditions on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Wisconsin is home to more than 1,800 miles of ATV trails. And according to the state cartographer's office, in the winter season, there are over 4,200 miles of trail options. So where do you ride? Do you live near an ATV trail? Do you mind four-wheelers coming through? It's 800-642-1234. Nick Webster is a Wisconsin DNR Recreation Ward, and he covers the South Central region, encompassing 11 counties. Nick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So what has the season brought forth for trails and for ATV use? What are you seeing out there?
Well, generally speaking, the trails down in this part of the state are in pretty darn good shape, but they are seeing a lot of traffic. It's really jumped up this year and last.
So when you say a lot of traffic, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, if you go to some of our trailheads, the common spots that people offload their machines and start from, most of those are full to capacity or well over, and people are kind of scrambling trying to find additional parking spots for their trucks and trailers to be able to offload.
So what does that mean for you, for trail maintenance, for upkeep?
It takes a little bit more time to keep those trails up. Our local clubs are helping out with that, and they're doing a really good job of keeping, you know, those trails that are maintained with gravel and graders. They're doing a really good job of keeping those up. But it does take some additional work.
Well, let's look at some nuts and bolts here. What can be registered as an ATV?
So the ATV and UTVs, they got a very specific definition. And unfortunately, that has changed a few times in the past. But what it comes down to is, you know, you're going to have a weight restriction. You're going to have an equipment restriction. So in the case of an ATV, you're looking at a machine that's 900 pounds or less, 50 inches wide or less, and it's got to be equipped with a seat that you straddle, kind of like a motorcycle,
mm-hmm.
and handlebars, not a steering wheel. So that stayed pretty consistent over the years. Three or more tires is part of that definition. So when somebody does go to purchase a machine with the intent of using it on ATV trails or UTV trails, I'd really suggest taking a look at our ATV or off-highway vehicle regulations and seeing specifically what's in that definition, because, like I say, unfortunately, that has changed a few times over the years, and you just don't want to get stuck, you know, with the machine that you might not be able to register and use the way you'd intend.
And ATVs are usually one person on that ATV, is that right?
Correct. Yeah, majority of the ATVs are built for one person. And if it's built for one person, that's all you can have on it. If you know, you're talking, if you want to have two people on an ATV, there are two up options that you can get right from the manufacturer. You know, they got a longer frame. They're designed to handle the more weight for two people. So if you do want to have two people on a machine, you got to make sure you have one that's built for it.
Well, contrast that to UTVs then.
So UTVs generally, you know, they're equipped for anywhere between two and six passengers. And you do have to remember with the UTV as well that you can only have passengers in those areas that are designed for passengers. So it's not legal to ride in the bed of a UTV or anywhere else. You have to be in a spot that's designed for an occupant with a seatbelt.
We're talking with Nick Webster of the DNR as we talk ATV trails and use. He's recreation warden. You can join in. Are you someone who enjoys riding an ATV on Wisconsin trails? Where do you like to ride? Have you taken an ATV safety course to get licensed? What did you learn? 800-642-1234. Nick, you know, when you look at these machines, do you see new safety equipment on them, like roll bars, or have their designs changed much at all?
The designs have really jumped over the years. I mean, if you look at where UTVs were, when we first started registering them back around 2012. The technology has really jumped. Suspension's been a lot better, a lot smoother ride. The technology is kind of followed the way of the electronic technology has come a long ways with those machines. Now, I mean, you're going down a road that's trail, I should say, an off-road trail, especially up north where it's not a nice groomed gravel, basically gravel road. Mm-hmm. You get on some of these off-road areas and they can really absorb those bumps well and really give you a nice soft ride.
You mentioned, go ahead, roll bars.
Yeah, so I was going to go down that road. Yeah, so you mentioned roll bars. UTVs, as part of their definition, have to have roll bars that are capable of protecting the occupants in a rollover crash. So there are a few machines out there that look like a UTV, but they don't have those roll bars. So you got to make sure that they have those to be able to meet that definition. And that bar will cover, all the occupants.
Yeah, what does that bar do? How does that look?
Generally, if you picture maybe a Jeep that's made for off-road or designed for off-road, they'll have aftermarket roll bars, a full cage basically around the occupants. And that's what it's there for, is just to help protect the occupants in a rollover. Mm-hmm. Now, along with that, to make that roll bar actually do its job and do it right, the occupants really need to be sure to have their seatbelts on. And it is a law in Wisconsin that, all the passengers in a UTV have to be wearing their seatbelts at all times. And I would say, the biggest part of my job is responding to fatal accidents, serious mm-hmm. accidents. And I can say without a doubt, the use of that seatbelt is probably one of the major factors in keeping people safe once those accidents do happen.
Mm. What about helmets and ATVs?
So helmets are required for anybody operating an ATV or UTV under the age of 18. Now, that's another thing very similar to the seatbelts. The instances that I've seen, if they can wear a helmet at all times, that's going to greatly increase their safety when it comes to, the unfortunate incident of a crash.
Yeah. Let's bring in Eric now in Green Bay. Hi, Eric. What would you like to ask the recreation warden?
I was wondering if and when the DNR is going to come out with an all-inclusive trail map for all the state trails and label it so that we know that where the roads are that you're driving on the roads instead of the trails. Because unfortunately, I get out there, but I haven't been out in a couple of years, so I really don't know. But it used to be so piecemealed. And you'd have to get, the Dusty Trail system and then the Langlade system and then the Dunbar system. And they're all, you had to try to match up and get from one trail system to the next trail system. And sometimes it wasn't even feasible. And then I remember I would get on one trail and it was pretty much, I was riding on a snowmobile trail and you weren't even supposed to be on snowmobile trails. So
Eric,
I was wondering if.
Yeah, Eric, thank you. Nick, what about the trail system map and Eric's question?
He hits on a really good point, and he's 100% correct. It can be a challenge at times. A lot of these trails are run by different municipalities, so they do change from time to time, and on a statewide basis, it's really hard to stay up with that. Some counties, limit those changes to once a year or twice a year, but, other municipalities might be changing them every month. And it can be really difficult to try to stay on top of a consistent, accurate statewide map. There's been some different entities that have reached out and tried to do regional maps, and those do exist, and some of those are pretty good. But the challenge does come with those consistent changes that happen, on the smaller scale, even down to the local township when they're implementing or reducing routes on the roads. So
where do you find those maps? Is there one repository for maps?
There's not one specific spot.
Okay.
The best thing I could say is, you know, reach out to your local counties, reach out to your local trails, clubs, and groups like that to see what they have. It is a challenge.
We have DNR Recreation Warden Nick Webster with us on ATVU. He's in the South Central region. How do you feel about ATV riders on state forest land? Do off-road vehicles pose a threat to your favorite outdoor activity, or do four-wheelers make the forest even more fun and accessible? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with the DNR's Nick Webster here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing ATV safety and Wisconsin trails on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In recent days, the Wall Street Journal reported on major supply chain disruptions at Polaris, that big manufacturer of ATVs based over in Minnesota. They had an unexpected surge in sales in the pandemic, and now customers are placing deposits on orders sent to factories. Are you trying to buy a new ATV? Can you get one? What trails are your favorite to ride? Join in 800-642-1234. Nick Webster is a recreation warden at the DNR. He's with us for about 9 more minutes. David is joining us from Prairie du Chien. Hi, David.
Good morning. I have a question. I live on a county road that is posted as a UTV, legal to drive on. But I get to the end of it and I run into State Highway 60. And then I have to go about a half a mile to get back on the trail. And I just wondered, is it legal to traverse that half a mile on the state highway to get to the next trail? Otherwise, you're just dead-ended.
David, thanks.
That's a good question. It's one that pops up around the state every year. So if that route that you're on, a designated route, you know, say the county highway you talked about, if that goes directly across the state highway, you're fine to do that. The scenario you're talking about where you got to go down the state highway for a stretch, the only way that you would be able to go down that state highway as part of that route system is if it was actually designated as a route. Now, traditionally statewide, the only places you're going to see those designated as a route is if that's in a municipality or an area where the speed limit on that state highway is less than 35 miles an hour. There are a few other places around the state that do have that designated as a route, but they're kind of few and far between.
David, does that help?
It does, but it doesn't. I mean, it doesn't make it effective for use of the UTV, especially we have a farm, and sometimes you're just, you know, trying to get to the next location, and it's like, well, you can't really use the vehicle for its intended purpose in that situation. So, thank you.
Well, you do. He does bring up a good point with the farming use. So that is a little bit of a different twist there. So if somebody is using an ATV or a UTV as part of what they call an implement a hub sentry, basically easiest way to describe that is like a tractor hauling or towing a load, like you'd normally use a tractor. During that time frame when they're using it as an implement a hub sentry, and if it's registered as for ag use, then they can go down that state highway, as long as they are using it just for implement a hub sentry and not for recreation.
Well, piggybacking a bit off of Eric and David's questions, do you think Wisconsin trails have adequate signage for ATV, UTV trails and showing the routes and what riders can and can't do?
Signage is something that's up to your local municipality. There's state law that says, you know, how it's intended to be signed and, you know, where those signs need to be. Mm-hmm. But when it comes right down to it, that's the responsibility of that local municipality who's putting it up, the county, the township, the village, to make sure it's up to par. Generally speaking, they do meet the standards. But like one of the last callers said, there's times when it can be a little difficult to follow those.
We're talking
new to an area.
We're talking with Nick Webster, who is DNR Recreation Warden covering the south central part of our state. We're discussing ATV trails, getting at your questions. Have you taken an ATV safety course recently to get licensed? What was it like? Do you live near an ATV trail? Do you mind ATVs riding through? Join in 800-642-1234. So, Nick, why are there so many more trails, miles of trails in the winter season?
We got some areas that are maybe sensitive trail base, and you don't want to get it tore up and rutted up, you know, in those summer months, or especially spring and fall when things are softer. And some of those trails are only open in the winter because you got a nice solid frozen base.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might be a bike trail that's okay with those lighter traffic of the bicycles. But then once the bicycles are not there and the ground is frozen, then they might open it up for ATVs or UTVs.
Okay.
It's just generally it's a trail. It can be related to the trail base.
What is the registration process like for ATVs? And does someone have to have their ATV registered?
Yep. You do have to have your ATV registered in Wisconsin. It's a 2-year registration, and it's $30. The easiest way to do that for the public registration is just to get on the DNR website. And if you just type in ATV into the search column, that's going to bring you right to pretty much everything you need to know for ATVs as far as registration, ATV safety classes, the rules and regulations, and it'll help you out quite a bit.
What do the safety classes entail, and who takes them?
So the safety classes are required for anybody that was born on or before January 1st of 1988. So, you know, you're getting people that are now into their 30s that do need to have a safety class to be able to operate an ATV on a public route or trail. And that's something that kind of surprises some people. But if you think about it, you know, we had to start somewhere with vehicles. You know, we all know that if you turn 16, you need to have a license on a car or a truck. And we're kind of going down that same route for ATVs and UTVs. It's just that we're kind of at the earlier stages of that,
mm-hmm.
and we're not to the point where everybody's used to it yet.
Let's bring in Brian now from Maguanago. Brian, hi. What would you like to ask?
My question is twofold. One, ATVs, six-wheeler, amphibious six-wheelers, my understanding is they are not allowed on any trails. But the bigger question is, do you know, can they be registered? Because my understanding is they can't because a UTV is 600 pounds and straddled.
Yeah, so those amphibious vehicles, so to be registered as a ATV, it needs to be, you know, 900 pounds or less. And it needs to have handlebars. So most of the amphibious vehicles that I've seen, and something may have changed, but have joysticks, almost like a skid
loader.
So that kind of takes them out of that picture. And plus, yeah, it doesn't have the seat that's designed to be straddled.
Okay. So they basically, there are registration issues, and they cannot be used on trails.
Correct.
Brian, thank you. Jim now from Madison. Hi, Jim. You want to ask about dirt trails?
Yes, I have small Woody's screw-in ice screws on my all four tires that I use when I'm out in the winter for ice fishing and stuff. And I'd like to do some trail riding, and I wonder, is it required that I take those little ice screws out for trail riding or on the dirt, or can I leave them in?
As far as the state's concerned, it's not illegal to keep them in. There may be local ordinances I would check in the area that you want to ride. Some places might be hesitant as to if that's going to cause issues with the roadways. Now, I would also be careful just that, you know, that added stress of running down the trail doesn't, you know, destroy your traction that you put in there.
Yeah. Jim, thank you. Do you find, Nick, that ice fishers use ATVs on the lake or to get to an ice shack?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, a lot use the ATVs and UTVs on a really consistent basis. They're nice and convenient. You can throw your stuff in the back or pull it behind. And, you know, for those areas that, you know, may have thinner ice, you know, they're quite a bit lighter than a vehicle.
Very quickly, you know, you've seen fatal accidents so many times. What is your top thing that you could relate to people about ATVs and UTVs?
I think the biggest thing that comes to the racks is consistently is the speed and intoxicated operation tend to be the leading factors in our fatals. We're starting to see a little bit of a rise in the use on the roads, and the way the machines are designed, they're just not designed to be on the roads as much, so that is becoming a factor as well.
Nick, thank you for joining us.
All right, thank you very much.
Nick Webster is a DNR Recreation Warden covering the South Central region. Ahead this hour, a troubling trend. New research reveals women are consuming more alcohol. We'll talk with a Harvard clinical psychologist. We'll be back after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a Sauk County dairy farm.
The devastation facing Wisconsin's family farms may have slipped from the headlines, but it hasn't stopped. Many are losing everything. Others are evolving and trying to make it. Wisconsin writer Brian Reisinger shares the struggle of one farm family, his own.
Most people never see a farm like ours. We don't just see it. You smell it and hear it. Like our cows coming into the barn for milking. It's one of those moments that sinks deep into your mind, then your blood and your bones, until it's there for good. At least, that's how our family feels, and also what we hope. Because after 100 years of Reisinger's dairy farming in Sauk County, we sold our cows and are looking for life after milking. Life not only for us, but our farm, too.
Well, this is our dairy farm.
My dad, Jim, started milking when he was 8.
My dad fell off of a corn crib out here. That's when I kind of got interested in farming because, well, my dad needed help.
Stories like that make it seem like family farms can stand forever, even against a changing economy that long ago left us behind.
Be honest with you, I hate to see them go. You know, I've been milking here all my life, born and raised here.
My dad and sister, Malia, have farmed together for almost 2 decades. My mom and I took our turns, too. But whenever I join Malia in our small 50-cal milk barn, I remember she's cut out for this in a way I'm not. When it dropped below zero this winter, she was 7 months pregnant and still milking.
Dairy cows are like working moms. So they go to work, they have to pump, where a beef cow is more like a stay-at-home mom that just takes care of her kid.
Milking got my great-grandparents through the Depression. My sister's kids mark 5 generations on this land. But things are different now. We planned our transition for more than a year, struggling over how to survive as other farms got bigger or disappeared. A farm is more than your job. It's your community and heritage. It's a way of life. But dairying is too hard financially and physically with my parents getting older. After years of breaking even, we needed a way to keep our farm in the family and fund their retirement. There's no 401k for farmers. We all have wondered if things could have been different. What if the economics were more in our favor? What could each of us have done differently a decade or more ago? I'll always ask, what if I'd been a farmer instead of a writer? My dad would have held on forever if COVID hadn't put him in the hospital. It literally took a global pandemic to stop him.
The stress is morning and night. Gotta be there. Being 69 and a half years old, that COVID that really hit me hard, I know I can't do it anymore.
We could have gone in debt to go bigger, but our family takes pride in being shoulder to shoulder with our animals.
Come on in.
Come on, baby.
Come on,
baby.
Come on.
So we're trying a new business model, raising heifers for other farms and cash cropping corn, hay, and soybeans. We're grateful to keep our 400 acres, but it still feels like something was taken from us. A few weeks before the cows went, we got together to milk. My mom, Jean, remembered being in the barn as newlyweds.
We would listen to the Grand Ole Opry, and when they would have the dances come on, we'd dance. It slows it down, but it makes It makes us such so much happier, and happy farmers make happy cows.
In March, big trailers rolled up to haul our cows away. The cows kept turning back, like they didn't want to go. Afterward, my dad roamed the farm, ending near the barn door where the cows come in, now only in our memory. On the cow's last day, they gave more milk than ever before.
We went out with a bang. The cows milked strong this morning. I mean strong.
He felt like they did it for him.
I think they made me new.
Brian Reisinger is a writer based in Madison who grew up on that dairy farm in Sauk County. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now, drinking among women is a growing health problem in the pandemic. More troubling to addiction researchers is the trend coincides with the rise in mental health issues among young women, and the long-term effects of the pandemic could worsen both. Are you or a loved one drinking a lot more in these times? Do you know a woman struggling with alcohol addiction? Are they getting help? It's 800-642-1234. Clinical psychologist Catherine McHugh directs the Stress, Anxiety, and Substance Use Laboratory at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts. She's an associate professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School. Kate McHugh, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with giving us a snapshot of how drinking has changed for women over the past few decades. What have you seen?
So historically, drinking was more common in men, and this goes back decades and decades. At times, you know, a ratio of 2-1, even 3-1. And over the last, frankly, several decades, women have caught up, and they've closed that gap to the point that men and women drink at roughly equal rates, and women almost have alcohol problems at the same rate as men do at this point.
What about now in the pandemic? What are researchers learning about women and alcohol?
There's been an interesting trend in the past two decades in particular. We've actually seen levels of drinking overall go down, particularly in youth. That has hit an inflection point in 2020, where we're now starting to see drinking levels go up. And those drinking levels appear to be going up more rapidly in women than in men.
So what accounts for the closing gap? Why are women turning to alcohol?
So this is not exclusive to the United States. We see this internationally. And one interesting trend is the place where women are catching up more are the places in the world with better gender equity, which of course is a good thing. But what we anticipate this is likely attributable to is increasing access. And once access to alcohol and even other substances is more equivalent, we see levels of drinking and levels of problem drinking start to become more equivalent between women and men.
What about the effects of stress? And I'm thinking about the job loss, the effects of being in high stress COVID units or another essential worker, the balancing act of family obligations. What factor does stress have in all of this?
So we know that stress is a risk factor for drinking for both men and women. However, it actually appears to be a bigger risk factor for women than for men. So for example, stress is more likely to be the reason for drinking in women than in men. We also know things like depression are more likely to precede an alcohol problem in women than in men. So in many ways, COVID has been a sort of a perfect storm when you think about, you mentioned family obligations. So the stress levels have been particularly high in women caretaking for young children who are oftentimes managing at-home schooling as well as their own work and sort of trying to meet those family obligations as well. Isolation, as you mentioned, many women are in the healthcare field where stress levels have been particularly high over the course of COVID. So in many ways, the combination of isolation, stress, family stress in particular has maybe a particular driving factor for why we're seeing these increases in women.
I'm wondering if you can explain substance use and that instant relief your patients feel, but are also battling, you know, mental health issues. What does that look like?
Right. And this is another place where we've seen just a tremendous effect of COVID. So COVID hits in two directions. So as you mentioned, alcohol provides relief of stress. And one of the tricky things is it provides immediate relief for very little effort. So if you imagine you're someone who has very little time and potentially limited resources to be able to cope with stress, alcohol can give that very quick relief. In the context of COVID, many people lost their other coping strategies. They couldn't go to a gym or go to dinner with friends or sort of have a break when kids go off to school. So that quick fix, that quick relief is very powerful. And in and of itself is not necessarily a bad thing until it becomes relied on too much, when it's the only strategy or when it's used in excess just to try to get relief from that stress. That's when we start to get into problem territory.
Yeah, I mean, I'm wondering if you can help us understand further, what is that problem territory? I mean, is it, you know, drinking too early in the day or too many drinks? But when does it become problematic?
So there are two things you can look at. One is the level of alcohol use. So we know that at certain levels of alcohol use, there are negative health consequences. And those can range from everything from cardiac and liver disease to risk for cancer, including risk for breast cancer in women. That level for women is typically consuming more than 3 drinks in a day or more than 7 drinks in a week. That's usually the cutoff for what we would call heavy drinking. So that's sort of one category. The other category is when drinking starts to become out of control, which effectively means that your drinking is now causing negative consequences, but you continue to drink anyways. So that could be anything from it causing psychiatric or health problems like depression to interfering with people's ability to engage in their roles. You'd mentioned sort of needing a drink in the morning, which may be a sign of physical dependence on alcohol. But effectively, once negative consequences start to creep in, that's when we're starting to look at an alcohol problem.
How are women's health outcomes, how are they different from men's when it comes to alcohol use disorder?
So when it comes to alcohol use overall, and let me start there, is that women and men metabolize alcohol differently. So all other factors being equal, if a female and a male consume the same amount of alcohol, the female's blood alcohol level will be higher. And this is one of the reasons why we think that the health consequences of alcohol are actually greater in women than they are in men. So that's sort of one issue. In terms of alcohol use disorder, once we get into problem drinking, typically women will have greater functional impairment than men. And basically that means more impairment in their family functioning, in their employment, in their health, in their psychiatric functioning. Alcohol use disorder appears to affect women to a greater extent than men in terms of their ability to function.
We have a psychologist, Kate McHugh of Harvard Medical School, explaining the rise in women consuming alcohol and binge drinking and the effects it has on health. Is someone in your life struggling with alcohol? Have you quit drinking? What's your experience been like as a sober woman? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A study published earlier this year in the Journal of Gynecology and Women's Health, it found women with higher levels of pandemic-related anxiety tended to drink more, including earlier in the day, more frequently, and in greater amounts. Women, what is your relationship with alcohol, especially in these pandemic times? Are you in a 12-step program? How are you battling alcohol abuse? Share your experience, 800-642-1234. We have Harvard Medical School psychologist Kate McHugh, who leads the Stress, Anxiety, and Substance Use Lab at McLean Hospital. Let's go to Sarah now in Green Bay. Hi, Sarah. What's been your experience?
Hi. I am actually a person who we would call a recovering alcoholic, or somebody that did abuse alcohol a lot earlier in my life. And I was able to kick it and have and get a healthy relationship with alcohol since then. However, I found that during the pandemic, I definitely went back to some of my old routines and my old ways because I found that I was very bored. And I know you spoke about that sooner, but or earlier, but I didn't have the resources and outlets that I used to use as healthy coping mechanisms. And I did see a definite increase in my drinking and for reasons of really just having nothing else to do and being bored and that being a definite trigger for me.
I wonder, Sarah, what were those healthy coping mechanisms that went away for you in the pandemic?
So in the past, exercise was definitely one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, heading to the gym, spending time with my friends, doing activities like shopping. Shopping was that retail therapy was definitely something that for me, just walking around thrift stores would take that trigger point away from me of that boredom or that, you know, there's nothing else to do and I'm stressed out kind of thing. And, you know, it just the things became fewer and fewer that I was able to do to cope with it. And it definitely was a struggle.
Kate McHugh, your insights here on lapsing in the pandemic.
Well, first, thanks so much, Sarah, for sharing your experience with that. Certainly, boredom is another major factor here. And I think your experience is really demonstrating that, that the things that you used to fill your time with that brought you reward and connection and joy were really limited in the pandemic. And I think if we think about the different potential triggers for alcohol, boredom is one, loneliness is one, stress is one. You know, these were all factors that were coming into play for many people. Again, that combination of high stress and removing potential rewards was tremendously difficult. And, you know, as we had talked about earlier, alcohol provides that quick fix. And in the moment when you're really bored or stressed, it can be tremendously difficult to make an alternative choice.
I wonder, you mentioned loneliness, and that has been an epidemic that's been a huge problem. What do you see there with the connections between loneliness and substance abuse?
So loneliness, we know from research, is, for lack of a better word, one of the most toxic things to our health and wellness. It's toxic to our long-term health. It's toxic to our mental health, and certainly is a major trigger for alcohol. Maintaining connectedness is one of the best things we can do, not only for our mental health, but also for our health. Again, in that isolation and that lack of reward, lack of meaning that I think can really settle in when you're isolated is a tremendous risk factor.
Sarah, thanks. Let's go to Lissa now from Green Bay. Hi, Lissa. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. I just had a quick question. Your guest had earlier talked about the impairment problems that women experience in their family and work seems to be more impacted by substance use disorder. I'm wondering how much social norms and expectations of women's behavior in those settings also plays a role with that.
And when you say social norms and expectations, can you go a little bit deeper there? What do you mean?
Well, how do I want to explain this? The expectation of how women interact in their families, how they interact at their jobs, what types of jobs they have, versus men and the expectations of them in the workplace or in their home lives.
Mm.
How much does that play a role in those impairment problems being more prominent?
Our social norms, gender norms. Kate McHugh.
So great question. This gender norms play a tremendous effect. So we know that women are more likely to have caretaking responsibilities, for example, both childcare and elder care. So you imagine if you have a group that has more of those responsibilities, there's more impairment to be had. So on the social and functional impairment, I anticipate that's likely a significant contributor. On the medical and psychiatric impairment, that may be more of, if we sort of separate sex being sort of the biological differences versus gender being more cultural, I think we probably see significant differences in both the body and the brain, as well as in the impact of those cultural norms.
And what are the implications of those cultural norms? How does that play out?
Well, it plays out in many ways. It plays out in terms of the, again, the level of impairment that may play out for someone with an alcohol use disorder. It also has implications for treatment.
Uh-huh.
So it can certainly be a barrier to treatment. If you imagine someone who has multiple caretaking responsibilities, perhaps they're also working, being able to get to a AA meeting or get to a therapy session can be exceptionally difficult. That requires time. It requires oftentimes childcare for people to be able to access those services. So really it affects the whole spectrum from risk to how these disorders play out to access to treatment.
We're talking with Kate McHugh, who directs the Stress, Anxiety, and Substance Use Lab at McLean Hospital in Massachusetts. She's an associate professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School, looking at the trend lines as women seek alcohol, and especially in these times. You can join in with your situation, 800-642-1234. You know, we live in such a quick fix society, and we want that instant relief. What are the difficulties for you in treating substance abuse and treating alcohol use disorder when the effects are not only physical, but emotional and psychological, and you may not be able to give that quick fix?
Right. It's one of the hardest things we contend with in treatment. And when people are trying to make this change is, you know, if we think of a healthy alternative, I know the exercise has come up a couple of times. Exercise is wonderful and will get you in some ways both a quick fix and a long-term fix. But the difference between picking up a drink and putting on your sneakers and going for a walk or going to the gym is very different, you know, and it requires more time, it requires more effort, and those changes can be very difficult to make. And that's where treatment really does come into play. The good news in all of this is we have very effective treatments, and they're effective medication treatments, they're effective behavioral treatments. You know, the one message that I think is really important for women to get is you don't have to do this alone. That's the hard way.
What do you see in AA and 12-step programs? Are they still your go-to for treatment, or are you pairing them with other things?
So it depends on the individual. For some people, a mutual help or self-help like AA, Smart Recovery is another model that's very popular. For some people, that mutual help is sufficient. And the good news there is that it's very easy to access, and particularly lately, there's even more in terms of web-based access to those types of services. Typically, once people get a little farther down the severity spectrum, so once someone really does have a sort of diagnosable alcohol use disorder, something like mutual help is typically more of an adjunct, which can certainly help improve outcomes. But typically, in those situations, working with a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a primary care physician, working with a health professional is usually going to be the way to go.
And quickly, as we wrap up here, what is still unknown? What research still needs to be done regarding women and drinking?
There are massive gaps in understanding, in part because women have been underrepresented in research in health in general and addiction in particular, really across the spectrum from very basic health research through health services research. So there are a number of gaps in terms of understanding what are the differences between men and women in terms of mechanisms for why they may drink, treatment effectiveness. We have probably more gaps than we have answers at this point.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Ben. My pleasure.
Clinical psychologist Kate McHugh is an associate professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School. If you or someone you know needs help, call the Wisconsin Addiction Recovery Helpline. That's 211, operates 24/7 for finding substance use and recovery services. That's 211. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.